Today is Wednesday, July 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, questions about the president's legal authority as the administration sends heavily armed U.S. agents to the streets of an American city.
This is very troubling because it violates specific constitutional protections.
The president resumes his coronavirus briefings as his polls sag, and he reverses course on one major issue.
We're asking everybody that when you are not able to socially distance, wear a mask, get a mask.
Also ahead, a major sentence for wildlife traffickers in Africa that could set a new precedent. It's all on today's International Edition. After months of refusing to wear a mask or ordering Americans to listen to health experts, U.S. President Donald Trump is now encouraging Americans to wear masks. Reviving his daily briefings on Tuesday, Trump departed from his usual rosy picture on the coronavirus pandemic outbreak in the U.S.
It will probably, unfortunately, get worse before it gets better. Something I don't like saying about things, but that's the way it is. It's the way, it's what we have. You look over the world, it's all over the world, and it tends to do that.
He also touted his administration's efforts to work with the nation's governors to conquer the disease that has claimed more than 140,000 American lives in just 5 months, despite having spent months contradicting his medical experts.
These trends could change without our continued and relentless focus, and that's what we have. We have a relentless focus, and it's been that way from the beginning.
It comes as the Republican governors of Texas, Florida, and Georgia, where COVID-19 is raging, have been pushing back hard against their local leaders who want to impose tighter restrictions. Hours after the president's news conference, Trump was seen at a gathering at his Washington, D.C. hotel, not wearing a mask. And as cases continue to rise globally and especially in the U.S., anti-science messages and conflicting information have added to confusion amid the massive national crisis. Joining us to talk about how much that is contributing to more cases and deaths is infectious disease specialist Dr. Ravina Kular. Thank you so much for being with us. So it would appear that we are really fighting more than just a battle against COVID-19, but also the battle for truth.
This definitely is, and I think that's what we're seeing happening in the U.S. It's so different than other countries which have almost tackled this virus. And there's this general anti-science, anti-authority feeling here in the U.S., and it's at a very high percentage. And it's almost like a conspiracy theories have unbounded here, where they think that the mandate of masks are inhibiting them from having a freedom here in the U.S., and that's not what it is. The only way that we can tackle this virus is by putting this mask on. There have been repeated studies that have shown this, repeated real-world scenarios that have shown this. I honestly wonder, I don't know what it's going to take, how many millions of people are going to have to die for the U.S. to really come together to realize the impact that masks have on tackling this virus.
Of course, in the beginning, they said they didn't think that they'd be that effective, but as they learned more, it seemed like health officials really changed their tune about this, and particularly most recently when they talked about the possibility that this is actually something that can be airborne.
That's correct. I mean, I remember I was on the news with Dr. Fauci in the beginning of this pandemic, and we both stated that masks are likely not beneficial. But with any new virus that appears, we learn about it every day. And by learning to see that this virus actually may potentially be airborne, likely most of it is by these respiratory droplets. But the only way that it's going to be prevented or decreased transmission is by putting that mask on. And recently, new data just came out that showing that masks not only protects others, but it also protects you in terms of if you're around somebody that has COVID-19 and the virus particles end up coming onto you, that mask protects you from getting infected. And if you do get infected, you have a milder form of COVID-19 than someone that did not wear a mask. So I think that's very promising.
It's interesting that there are governors, they feel like somehow they're infringing on their citizens' rights by refusing to require wearing masks. In the state of Georgia, the governor is suing to stop the mayor of Atlanta from enacting a mask requirement.
Very shocking. And you see there's leadership which is doing that. And it makes any public question what is happening here and feel almost confused. Like, should you put it on? Should you not? There's a suing of, of there being a mandate for masks? So does that mean maybe you shouldn't wear masks? And nowhere else in this world do you see mm-hmm. such a confusion happening. And that's right. why here in the U.S., we don't have strong leadership. And until we get strong leadership and a unified approach, we will be constantly battling this virus.
In the past here in the U.S., we would go to the experts, the scientists, the health professionals. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't think a pandemic would become so politicized like it is. And that, you know, we've heard some promising news on vaccines that they're making progress. I would imagine we probably still have a long way to go. And as you said, the masks are going to be the best preventative measure. But also, even if we have a vaccine, if we have people that are anti-science and skeptical, there was a new poll out that 50% of people, something to that degree, wouldn't even be willing to get one.
Yeah, I mean, that's very concerning. There's that report that said anti-vaccine content you see on social media continues to flourish, despite platforms that are claiming that they will limit the spread of coronavirus-related misinformation. So I think that you see that even if there is a vaccine that comes out, you're going to see many anti-vaccinators going against, and again, it's going to be a political issue, that maybe there's something behind this mandate for vaccines at a certain mm-hmm. time for COVID-19. Hmm. It goes right behind that mandate for a mask right. issue happening. Very concerning.
Right, because if we have a vaccine and people won't get it, then obviously they can be spreaders, right?
Correct.
I mean, that makes sense.
Correct.
And along the same line, with just the conflicting information, Americans don't exactly know what's up and down anymore. You know, with the numbers approaching 4 million cases right now, I know that the Infectious Disease Society of America was very concerned about the Trump administration changing its policy to bypass the Centers for Disease Control with COVID-19 data. How big of a deal is that?
And it's a huge deal. The CDC has been collecting data from hospitals about patients and healthcare workers' safety for decades. Now, this data is being taken into the hands of the administration, and there's a separate reporting system. It's now being run by the private government sector by a company called Teletracking, and that puts all this health data into the hands of the government, which is not accessible to any healthcare providers, to the public. It's almost like communism at its finest, right? It's like it's held at the hands of the government, and there's no almost open system to see what's happening. And the data that will be reported, will it be accurate or will it be biased? We don't know. And there you see again that move, again, is undermining science and credibility in the midst of a pandemic. So what you're seeing again here, it goes along that anti-science movement. It's the same thing. It's taking science from the hands of CDC, which is a credible agency which has dealt with pandemics, with infectious diseases, outbreaks, and it's being given to the hands of the government.
Infectious disease specialist Ravina Kular. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden is pitching the next part of his plan to rebuild the post-coronavirus economy, this time focusing on older and younger Americans. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Biden's trying to show voters how the virus pandemic can provide job growth opportunities. His campaign's released a massive plan to create 3 million new jobs, caring for the elderly and providing preschool for all 3- and 4-year-olds. It would also offer low- and middle-income families tax credits to help pay for child care. The plan's slated to cost $775 billion over 10 years. Biden's promising to pay for it by cutting some real estate investor tax breaks and boosting compliance with existing tax laws for high earners. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Oregon's attorney general is suing the Trump administration for deploying federal forces and tactical gear to crack down on Black Lives Matter demonstrators in the city of Portland. Federal officers have used tear gas, hit people with batons, and whisked some away in unmarked vehicles. It's setting up the potential for a constitutional crisis that could escalate, as President Trump says he plans to send federal agents to other major cities. Joining us now is UC Hastings constitutional law professor Joel Paul in San Francisco. Thank you so much for being with us. Is sending these federal forces into American cities constitutionally legal?
The president is using forces that have been specifically funded by Congress for purposes for which they were not intended. So the president is using the Border Patrol to patrol the streets of Portland, Oregon. That's not why Congress is funding the Border Patrol. The Border Patrol is there to prevent illegal trafficking and illegal immigration. Similarly, the president apparently is using the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard, the argument is that they can use the Coast Guard within 100 miles of the coast, but clearly this is not a proper use of the Coast Guard. The misuse of these forces is very troubling because the president seems to be using them as if they are a personal guard, a kind of praetorian guard to protect the president, and not for the purposes for which Congress is funded.
We've heard reports, or we've seen some of these forces hitting protesters with batons, lots of tear gas. It certainly seems like it's escalating, but one of the big concerns that we're hearing about is these officers, they're not identified, pulling people into unmarked vehicles as if they're, you know, taking them into custody, but not identifying themselves or saying what crime they've committed or where they're taking them. That's really not something we see in the United States.
This is very troubling because it violates specific constitutional protections afforded to the accused. You can't just simply grab someone on the street and throw them into an unmarked vehicle. You've got to give them their Miranda rights. You have to tell them why they're being arrested. You have to identify yourself. And the failure to do those three things constitutes a clear constitutional violation.
I guess that would explain why the state of Oregon, the American Civil Liberties Union, and others have filed suit against these forces even being deployed to Oregon.
Yes, so the state of Oregon also undoubtedly feels that the federal government here is stepping in and performing what is essentially a state function, that is to provide police protection in the streets of Oregon. And in doing so, the federal government is also stepping on the 10th Amendment rights of the state. The state is a sovereign, and the federal government cannot simply assume state functions.
The president now also threatening that he will send these forces to other cities. We are hearing where he may already be in the process of doing that. This is raising a lot of alarm bells in this country. This is something we have never seen. And it's worrisome when you see the videos of these massive forces with these protesters.
This is a very worrisome moment in the country for the president to be using forces this way. I think that there's reason to hope that lower courts will agree that you cannot use forces for this purpose and you can't intrude on people's rights. I'm also confident that in the final analysis, that the president will not be able to use the United States military because the United States military is expressly forbidden from engaging in law enforcement functions domestically. So it is a worrisome sign, and much will ultimately depend on Congress and on the next election.
Joel Paul, constitutional law professor at UC Hastings Law School in San Francisco. The Egyptian parliament voted in a closed-door session this week to authorize President Abdel Fattah Sisi to deploy troops to neighboring Libya should the need arise. Sisi warned the Tripoli-based government of national unity and its backers in Turkey earlier this month not to try to cross a red line Egypt considers vital to its security in the Libyan coastal port of Sirte. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
The vote in Egypt's parliament for President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to intervene in Libya did not appear to set off any immediate military activity by rival forces in Libya. Meanwhile, Egyptian media reported that Sisi spoke with U.S. President Donald Trump in a phone call Monday night, which focused on the need for a ceasefire in Libya to prevent further escalation of the ongoing conflict. In a statement following its Monday vote, the Egyptian parliament said it unanimously approved deploying members of the Egyptian armed forces on combat missions outside the country's borders to protect Egyptian national security. Parliament must approve any decision for Egypt to go to war by a two-thirds vote. Libya's eastern-based parliament issued a statement a week ago authorizing Egypt, which supports the interim government of Abdullah Thani in eastern Libya, to intervene militarily if necessary due to what it called Turkey's blatant intervention in Libya and breaching of the country's sovereignty. Egypt's foreign minister, Sama Shoukry, said over the weekend that Cairo is watching the situation in Libya closely.
He said Egypt is keeping close tabs on the situation in Libya and will take decisive measures to protect Arab national security. Egyptian MP Emad Gad told Arab media that Parliament's vote to give President Sisi a green light to intervene in Libya does not mean a declaration of war, and that Parliament did not specify when or how the president might intervene. Libyan analyst Aya Borwaila, visiting lecturer at the Hellenic National Defense College, tells VOA that Egypt also is counting on Libyan tribal forces from all parts of the country to play a role in resolving the ongoing conflict. Egypt, she says, understands that Libya's political and social life is organized around tribes whose will and interests should not be circumvented. Meanwhile, the French aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle recently deployed off of Sirte to monitor any possible advance by Turkish-backed militia forces, according to Arab media. Paris supports Eastern-backed military commander General Khalifa Haftar. In other diplomatic activity, Algerian President Abdelmadjid Tebboune told Algerian TV that his country supports a political solution to the Libya conflict. He says he's been in daily contact with the main players in the Libya crisis, including Russian President Putin, French President Macron, Tunisian President Kais Saied, and with Turkish officials by way of Gulf intermediaries. Tebboune adds that he thinks the conflict must in the end be solved through negotiations. The Tripoli government's interior minister, Fatih Başaga, visited the Turkish capital Ankara Monday to discuss the Libyan situation with Turkish defense minister Hulusi Akar and Malta's defense minister. Libyan army spokesman Colonel Khalid Mahjoub told Arab media that Turkey has sent thousands of militia fighters and mercenaries to fight his forces, including mercenaries from Syria and Tunisia. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Israel reportedly carried out airstrikes in Syria near Damascus Monday for the first time in several weeks, targeting Iranian-linked sites. It comes after a series of explosions in Iran itself over the past few weeks. While Israel may not have been responsible for all of the attacks in Iran, Linda Grantstein, reporting from Jerusalem, says some there believe Iran, which is suffering from sanctions and the pandemic, could strike Israelis as a way of diverting attention.
This is what it sounded like in a town south of Damascus on Monday night. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a monitoring group in Britain, said there were several explosions around the town of Kiswa, a town that has long been associated with Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards. The airstrikes hit weapons depots and military positions belonging to Iran-backed militia fighters. The Syrian news agency blamed Israel, saying the missiles were fired from the Golan Heights. Israel did not confirm it was behind the attack. Israeli forces have carried out hundreds of similar attacks in the past. The strikes also raised tensions between Israel and Iran, already running high. A series of fires and explosions over the past 10 days in Iran has also contributed. Most notably was an explosion in the Natanz area at a plant where centrifuges were manufactured that analysts in Israel said would delay Iran's nuclear program by at least a year. The New York Times newspaper quotes an unidentified senior Israeli official, widely believed to be the head of the Israeli Mossad, that Israel was responsible. Former senior U.S. official John Bolton told Israel's Army Radio Tuesday he supports these attacks on Iran.
I don't claim to have any special knowledge how these various events happened, but they seem clearly aimed at both the Iranian nuclear weapons program and its ballistic missile program. I think whoever's doing it, they have my complete support. Maybe dissidents inside Iran, maybe working with outsiders, maybe a combination. But look, even despite the economic pressure that has been put on Iran since the U.S. withdrew from the nuclear deal, there's obviously still a lot more to do. And I think this is exactly what we need.
But some Israeli analysts say that Israel should be careful about antagonizing Iran. Iran is faltering under a serious economic crisis and international sanctions, as well as the COVID-19 pandemic. Iranian leaders are still angry about the U.S. targeted killing of Revolutionary Guards leader Qasem Soleimani in January. The Iranian currency, the rial, has lost half of its value in recent months. Analysts say Iran might launch a direct attack, or more likely use its proxy Hezbollah to launch an attack on Israel to divert attention from Iran's difficult situation. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The U.S. Justice Department on Tuesday indicted two Chinese nationals over their role in what the agency called a decade-long cyber espionage campaign that targeted defense contractors, COVID researchers, and hundreds of other victims worldwide. European Union leaders early Tuesday clinched a historic deal on a massive stimulus plan for their coronavirus-battered economies, after a contentious summit lasting almost 5 days. The agreement paves the way for the European Commission, the EU's executive, to raise billions of euros on capital markets on behalf of all 27 states, an unprecedented act of solidarity in almost 7 decades of European integration. Malawi National Parks and Wildlife officials have declared victory after a court sentenced 9 members of a Chinese wildlife trafficking gang to a total of 56 years in prison. Members of the Ling Zhang group were found guilty of trafficking protected animal species and parts, including pangolins, rhino horn, and ivory. The alleged kingpin of the syndicate is due to appear in court later today. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The 9 are part of a 14-member wildlife trafficking gang who Malawian police arrested in May of last year. It includes 2 Malawians. And 12 Chinese nationals. Some of the Chinese are already serving 6-year prison terms in the capital, Lilongwe. Passing more sentences Monday, Magistrate Florence Segandiana also ordered the Chinese traffickers to be deported immediately after serving their sentences. Defense lawyer Gilbert Konyongwa told VOA Tuesday he could not say anything because he has yet to see the printed copy of the sentence.
With my clients, we need to go through it and appreciate the basis why the court has given such sentences before we make a decision as whether to leave it at that or to appeal.
Brydon Kunchedwa is director of Malawi's National Parks and Wildlife Agency. He told VOA via a messaging app that the sentencing is a victory towards the country's efforts in combating wildlife crimes.
We are looking at a foreign syndicate terrorizing Southern Africa and Malawi included. And now those culprits that have been given 11 years, they are already serving another 6 years, which means they'll be behind bars for 17 years. I'm sure the cartel now is being dismantled of these criminals.
Kunchedwa says the foreign syndicate has been recruiting locals to take part in wildlife trafficking for the past 10 years. The British-based Environmental Investigation Agency, which campaigns against environmental crimes and abuse, welcomed the sentencing. Its executive director, Mary Rice, told VOA via a messaging app that the ruling shows Malawi has demonstrated that it's possible to get rid of such syndicates within one's own borders.
In this particular case, it's been a very long, hard road. The syndicate was very well connected and did try every which way to get away from the rule of law, but there was tenacity and clear leadership, which demonstrates that you can actually identify and prosecute these individuals.
The alleged kingpin of the syndicate, Yong Huan Lin, was arrested in August of last year following a 3-month manhunt. He is expected to appear in court to answer charges of possession of rhino horn, conspiracy, and money laundering. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
You're listening to International Edition. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And to AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. The South Africa International Ballet Competition was forced online this year due to COVID-19, but becoming the first international ballet competition to go entirely virtual didn't detract supporters. The competition earlier this month attracted competitors from 30 countries from around the world, the largest participation ever for the biennial event. Maurice de Klerk reports from Johannesburg.
The COVID-19 pandemic's cancellation of most events almost crushed South African ballet dancer Sikhumbuzo Hlahleni's dream to compete worldwide. Instead, he became part of ballet history when the South African International Ballet Competition this year leapt into cyberspace. But taking part in a dance competition by recorded video, says Hlahleni via Zoom, was not easy.
I haven't been on stage for quite some time, and because of this COVID. And I told myself that the only thing I need to do here is to have fun. And for me, it was quite challenging because the audience wasn't there, the judges wasn't there. So I felt so lonely.
Africa's premier global ballet contest is held every 2 years with age categories ranging from primary school children to adults. But because of safety concerns due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the competition was moved online. The number of participants almost doubled. The SAIBC's CEO, Dirk Badenhorst, explains through Zoom.
There were 255 videos that our panelists had to view. The number of countries represented doubled. Due to the fact that it's online, people didn't have to fly, so they saved a lot of money in the actual cost of attending.
Contestants recorded one classical and one modern performance to upload 2 weeks before the competition. A jury of global dance judges watched the recordings and then uploaded their video reviews. Jury chairperson and director of the Dutch National Ballet, Ted Branson, was at first skeptical of an online dance contest. But speaking via Zoom, he said he changed his mind.
It is a format that can actually work and that actually can give more opportunities to people who otherwise would be missing out. So it is a really valuable lesson. It has its pros and cons, but I think for this particular event, it has worked out really, really well.
40 cabanas, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 4.
During the week-long contests, experts like the Zurich Academy of Ballet's Roberta Martens offered online training and panel discussions. South African-born ballet dancer Toriso Mahongwa says the virtual initiative is a ballet game changer.
This is a huge platform for possibilities. So I think it's really literally opened the floodgates for possibilities for our students. To keep ballet as part of our lives, we've got to let it evolve.
The South African International Ballet Competition ended July 18 with a virtual awards ceremony and an online gala concert. Marisa de Klerk for VOA News, Johannesburg.
An apartment in the city. American folk singer, songwriter, activist, and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member Joan Baez is this year's recipient of the Woody Guthrie Prize, an award that recognizes artists who speak out for the less fortunate. Baez will be honored with a virtual ceremony on August 16th. The Woody Guthrie Center director noted Baez's activism that included marching for civil rights and opposing the Vietnam War. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.